Hello, Carol. Welcome to E Pluribus Unum, your favorite podcast about the show Pluribus. Today, we're going to be doing a season one autopsy where we go over our thoughts about the first season of Pluribus in totality. And we're welcoming back a guest speaker this time. Welcome back, Joe. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm glad to be back. Thanks for inviting me. I had such a great time the last time, and getting to come getting a little arguing about this show is just right for me. I feel great.
Joe's ready for some arm wrestling is what it sounds like. Well, before we start arm wrestling, Joe, let's talk to people about having a discussion about Pluribus as a whole. We would love for you to join us on our Discord server. We will have that in our show notes. If you need a direct link, or if you go onto social media, you'll find a link there as well. We should be pretty easy to find. E Pluribus Unum, A Pluribus Podcast. Also, we want to encourage you to listen to our other podcast, Dad, You're Wrong, where a Gen X dad and a millennial son discuss film, philosophy, and everything in between. And also, apparently, I'm wrong a lot. We just did our top 10 episode for 2025, where we had two very lovely guests join us, and we went through our top 10 as a whole. We also did our top five for television. So if you appreciate our E Pluribus Unum podcast, we think you'll get a kick out of Dad, You're Wrong, and you'll find it in all the same places you listen to your current podcasts.
Today, for our season one autopsy, we're not going to be doing episode by episode. We're really going to be digging into what we thought worked, what we thought didn't work, some theories that we have for the series as a whole, and maybe even some predictions for season two. I think a good place to start this conversation, though, is just a good overview, first reaction to the season as a whole. Joe, what did you think? Just an overall high level reaction to season one of Pluribus.
Well, I went in completely blind. I saw the ads that just showed Carol's face, I believe, and maybe the tagline, you know, the most unhappy person in the world saves the world from happiness, and thought, what could that possibly mean? I did know that it was Vince Gilligan, and I'm familiar with his work, and I'm a fan. So for me, it was really exciting to dive in blind. That first episode remains a high point to me. It just shocked me. I did not know what was coming. I really didn't expect it to be a The World is Overrun series. And then I was doubly startled by just how the joined are presented. It was surprise after surprise. I just never knew what was coming. The show doesn't feel like a lot of other shows to me. It feels like a fascinating thought experiment. And it kept me on my toes the whole time. And I honestly found the end very satisfying.
I feel somewhat similar to you, Joe. I didn't really have too much expectation going into Pluribus, simply since I made sure not to watch anything. The only thing I really saw prior was the yellow marketing still of the Petri dish. What really got me, though, and what I was disappointed in, was right before I got to see the first episode, I had saw some bonehead online with a comment that said, oh, it's just Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And that hurt me so bad because I had no idea what it was about. And then this guy just drops a comment like that. It was so aggravating. But luckily, you know, Gilligan definitely subverted that. It goes far beyond any sort of just another rehash of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And I think overall, I was happy with this first season. I had my own problems with the ending in particular, but beyond that, I'm very much in the camp of enjoying season one of Pluribus.
I have to say the same thing as Joe. I like to try to go in as blindly as possible, because any more you watch a trailer and it can spoil the whole film. But we know that Vince Gilligan's not going to do that. And even with the marketing he had for Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, when he would show a trailer for an upcoming episode, you couldn't get any context out of it until you finally watched the episode. And I think that is a really beautiful payoff. It's the payoff of seeing the scene in the actual context that makes it so cool. So a brilliant way to run pretty much anything. I love the marketing on this, by the way. The theme song is marvelous. The yellow and the use of yellow throughout the entire season, everything just pulled together in such a beautiful way. I thought that we were going to get another Gilligan property, so I was fine with that. So for him to sort of flip it and give it a sci-fi twist was very compelling. I'm very glad that he released the first two episodes right off the bat, because I almost needed to see the second episode just to satiate the hunger from the first. I would say the sci-fi element was the thing that probably caught me most off guard in the first or second episode, where there is a tonal shift in the show differing from Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul. And I think he's just maybe leaning a little bit more into his old X-Files days, right? He's going back to his Lone Gunman days here a little bit. And he definitely has not lost his humor or his bite. And I'm very appreciative of that. So it was neat to sit down and watch those first two episodes blind and be so satisfied from the get-go. Joe, I've got a question for you directly. Now that we're through the first season, we have all nine episodes in front of us. Do you feel that it worked? You know, as a complete nine episode arc, did it earn that slow burn, or did it sort of test your patience?
I've been told that some people find it slow. I did not. This is the kind of show for me where I wasn't doing anything else when it was on. When an episode was on, I saved it until I had an hour to watch it. And then I sat down and watched it, and I got sucked into the world. In trying to pick a least favorite episode, I had a hard time, because to me, it just felt like laying bricks in this wall or threads in a tapestry. Every little piece seemed to add something else to it. Every moment when I would think back on it had more to offer than what I originally thought it did. I don't have a lot of bad things to say about it. One of my favorite things that a show can do is get the engine of my head spinning. Later, when I'd find myself contemplating the communal experience versus the individual and just philosophical concepts, what would I do if I had Carol's world, or if I had Kuma's opportunities? What would I do? To me, the show just worked great in general.
Josh, you and I talk about artists, and we talk about what is their intent? What are they trying to say? And you and I haven't actually talked about it when it comes to this show. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think Gilligan is trying to say with this show?
The big idea that we've talked quite a bit about is humans' interaction with AI and how the hive mind typically behaves very much like an LLM. And the hive mind has this inability to create anything. It can only steal. Right, it can only take from what has been created by humans. And I know Vince has pushed back on that idea, but I can't help but get that with every theory and every episode and every conversation that pops up with Carol or with Manusos and how they interact with the hive mind. But there's quite a bit more that you can take from it. There's also how a person might deal with an abusive relationship, and how a person might deal with manipulation, how a person deals with loneliness as well. The idea that I keep coming back to is the future that we're approaching with the over adoption of artificial intelligence, and how a lot of folks are not using it as a tool, but using it as a creation engine. And what are we without creation, right? Do we lose our humanity at that point if we cease to create? And there's also the conversation to be had about individuality and community. He sees the importance of community, and he sees the importance of still having an identity outside of that community. So again, just so many ways to approach this, and it's one of the few shows out there that begs that sort of conversation.
We are lucky to be able to break down some of the things that are, when you think about it, speculative or just guessing as to the direction that he has us going in. But we get to have these really fun and I consider smart conversations with people about it. And it's a really great reason and opportunity for two or more people to just sit down and talk. When I think about this, though, I think about when Joe was with us on episode 7, and you both hit on it, but Joe really was camped in the camp of transcendence. And I want to ask you, now that we've come to the end and we're looking at the season as a whole, do you still feel that the joined represent transcendence, or do you have a different feeling and thought about that now?
I'm not putting myself in that side necessarily. It just felt like a part of the conversation that I didn't hear happening. And I think that it's the tension that the show rests on, for me, philosophically at least. And I see myself as being very individualistic and also at times being a cog. I feel both of those things. So now you have a show like this, it draws the lines real stark so that you have a playground on which to really play with these ideas. And so my question was, do we know what it's like to be one of the joined? We don't. And so I just found myself going, how do we know that it's the villain? It's not that I expect to find out that the joined are a transcendent experience, that Carol in the end joins them and they all become a part of the cosmic force or something. But to me, what makes the show so interesting is that as soon as I start to wonder one way, it throws something at me to make me think of it the other way.
You know, I've fallen prey to that as well, but I would say that's kind of part of the roller coaster ride of it. And it was also the way that I was able to deal with my own little Soylent Green episode. But I would go back and also say, when it comes to the philosophy of the joined or the weirdos and their biological imperative, as they call it, I find more than enough evidence to show that they are most certainly the villain, especially just with what we saw in episode 9. The facade stops, but they all still have that goddamn creepy smile on their face. And it's unnerving as shit. If you act that way, you are a psychopath. That's psychopathic behavior, when a person comes to you to your face and behaves a certain way, but as soon as you turn your back are completely contrary to that. I don't need any more evidence. And, you know, now Carol, through her full arc of her experience, doesn't need any either.
I also see it as putting away the stuff in the baby room when the baby grew up. Yes, they're all smiling, and yes, that's creepy to us, but we don't know what's going on inside them. Maybe that is just how they feel. And maybe when you say they're putting on a facade, well, they were trying to make her feel comfortable in a situation that's clearly extraordinarily uncomfortable and strange. So if I was going to play devil's advocate for the joined, I would say that it was no longer necessary to do those things to make her feel comfortable. Now she is comfortable. She's one of us.
Well, let me ask you guys this. Do you think that the show earned its ending? I want to cue Josh first. Do you think that this season earned its ending?
One of the big criticisms with this show is with the pacing. And we do live in a world of instant gratification, and we live in a world of Kumbas, really, right? And I could see that idea coming from a lot of the Kumbas out there in the audience. I had the opposite feelings on the season. I thought it was incredibly well-paced. And when it comes to the question of, did the show earn its ending, I think I would flip it on its head a little bit. And I think that the ending didn't earn the show. It felt like the penultimate episode. It felt like a step backwards and then finally a step forwards at the end. And it felt like the ending brought us back to where I thought we would be at the beginning of episode 9. And it feels almost as if we're missing an episode. There should be an episode 10 out there. And maybe it's due to the fact that I tend to watch an episode twice and I tend to talk about it for 2 hours with you guys. The frozen egg reveal was so foreshadowed that I anticipated that fairly early on. And it didn't feel like that much of a reveal for me. And also, I felt disappointed in Carol as a character by choosing the hive, but also I felt disappointed that she didn't pick up on that possibility earlier on, especially when it was brought up in conversation earlier within that episode. Carol is La Turca, and La Turca would have known better, I think.
Joe, what are your thoughts? Do you believe that the we got an arc here. Do you think that the season earned its ending? And frankly, are you excited about the second season?
I went from seeing Carol as sort of a spoiled person who ostensibly has everything she wants, but can't seem to find a way to enjoy it or be happy, who goes through this massive trauma. We have a person whose partner has died. She then has the guilt of inadvertently killing thousands of people, looking into the eyes of the families of those people, and realizing that her natural reaction to this is dangerous on such a level is another traumatic experience. Human beings, we need people. We are a collective, whether we like to think of it or not. No one is an island. That's why solitary confinement is such a punishment. These are things that cults do to people. They break you down. So I think it's easy for a lot of us who have never fallen prey to a cult to be like, oh, they're so weak, or I would be better. But all people have a breaking point. We're all vulnerable at some level. To me, this is what makes her human, what makes her different than the joined, and she chooses to be a part. And so for her to go through that and then have that moment where she suddenly feels terribly betrayed and she finds her resolve again, to me, that is an arc. And to me, it was very satisfying.
Well, what I'd like to talk to you guys about now is Carol. I would really like to do a deep dive into just her and her character and maybe a few Carolisms along the way here. Here's the big question that seems to be on everybody's mind. Is she a hero? Is she an anti-hero? Or is she neither? Josh, do you have a strong feeling one way or the other?
It's a tough question for me still after the season and really mulling it over. She's very much the protagonist. Even those of us that felt the hive mind wasn't necessarily an antagonist early on, I think came to grips with the hive mind being the opposition, and that we found the worth throughout the series of being an individual. When we lost Carol to the hive mind after the charm offensive, that's when I was most disappointed. And that's when I felt that this wasn't the Carol that I've come to know over the first 8 episodes of this series.
Sounds like you're definitely landing in the hero camp. But you mentioned earlier on in the last episode of E Pluribus Unum about how they almost needed to do that. And I think the reason that they do those simplified things where they drop the hints or they give the foreshadowing or they're a little heavy-handed with some of the messages is that we have a broad audience here. And I think the broad audience needs a broad brush in some instances in order to really push the story forward and the characters' arcs forward. And I think that might be why it's there. So I'm trying to look at it through another audience member's perspective where they need more information to really be able to enjoy the depth of the show. Joe, what are your thoughts? Is she a hero to you, an anti-hero? Neither. Does she break the mold?
I would definitely say that she is a protagonist. A hero is a person who is up against something that they can't defeat, and they have to become something they don't necessarily want to become, and they do it for the betterment of others. And to that end, I think Carol is definitely proving to be a hero. Being disappointed in her for falling into their arms feels strange to me. I wasn't disappointed in her at all for that. So is she a hero? Seems to be.
I like the concept of an anti-hero. I like the concept of it's not black or white. You know, what is Gilligan's speciality? It's morally compromised protagonist. And that just fits her so well. And part of the quote-unquote disappointment that anyone might have had in Carol in the last episode was that we thought she was someone else, but we got to see her bad side. We all have our bad side. But it made it more real. It made it more grounded. It made it more relatable, frankly. And I think she does break the mold a little bit. Because she's human, she's able to be compromised, as we saw before, just like any of the rest of us. But I like the idea that maybe she needed to go through that so that she could come back clear-headed and do what needs to be done with Manny. It leads us to this next segment in a really wonderful way. I would like for us to share our favorite Carolisms. The show is chock full of them. I think the one that stuck with me from the beginning was in Grenade, where she says, "There's nothing wrong with me that a fucking hand grenade wouldn't fix." I've definitely been in that room before. She makes good points by giving us these one-liner sort of zingers. One point in episode 2, she says, "Oh, great. So all the fucking lawyers in the world survived," when they were talking about their diet. So when she just kind of throws those out there, they can't help but stick. Another favorite of mine is when she's laying in the bottom of the recycled dumpster and says, "You motherfuckers sure love your milk, don't you?" And it's just so funny, you know, and out of context, it's even funnier, I think. But just those alone are some of my favorites.
Yeah, there's plenty of them. Another one that comes to mind is when she says, "All the brains in the world and you can't navigate a fucking pronoun."
That's one that's worth rewinding.
I think it's when they're at that dinner amongst all the unjoined, and she says to Lakshmi, "Because I'm smart enough to know you don't ask a drug dealer to describe their heroin," when she's like, "Why should we listen to anything you say?"
That was so pointed, too, and what sucks is it goes completely over their head. Well, some solid Carolisms there. I think those are really great. This leads us to our next segment, and I think some people's favorite character, but you obviously have to bring a Carol up first. Let's talk about Manny in depth here.
In looking back on it, I love that his first interaction is to basically tell Carol to shove off on the phone, which is obviously his attitude towards all the joined. When you watch him licking those tins out of the garbage because he will not eat anything from them, you know, that tells you something right there about who you're dealing with here. He comes across as, I guess, a tight ass to me. He doesn't seem like he'd be fun at parties, but maybe that's not the kind of person you want trying to save the world when a cult has taken it over.
Do you not recall that smile he gave Carol in her living room when he politely asked her for the phone? That was the most charming smile I've seen, frankly, all season, to be honest.
It felt as put on to me as anything the joined have ever done.
Oh, man. Deep cut. Deep cut on Manny.
He was doing what he had to do in that moment, which he's demonstrated he will do. Like I was saying before, the fact that he is willing to change his tactics and to accept new information seems like one of the more vital parts of his character, next to his stubbornness.
Well, Josh, I know that you really championed Manny from the get-go. What was it about Manny that immediately made him your favorite character?
Yeah, I had a lot of time to think and mull over Manny and figure out why I found him so admirable. And when it comes down to it, Manny is just such a force of nature. He is distilled willpower. Just the fact that he would do things like eat the dog food and force that down instead of eating this homemade meal from his mother, who is now one of the joined, up until his journey up the Pan American Highway and to literally cross the impassable gap that is the Darien Gap, despite the warning of the hive mind. He never questioned his journey and he never took a step back. And I always found that respectable. And when he truly sort of won me over and in being my favorite character of this show and perhaps of the year in television was the car burning scene. When he says goodbye to his car in such a loving way and burns it as he's staring into the eyes of one of the joined, it was just quintessential Manny. And he progressed so well throughout the series.
Joe, do you think we could have this show without Manny?
I think that since Carol is our viewpoint character from the beginning, and are there really any other characters where it's from their viewpoint other than Manny? I can't think off the top of my head of any. The fact that our protagonists themselves have such different defining features seems to be built into the structure of the show and is an engine. I've been thinking ever since that episode 7 that there could be some point where these two are literally at odds with each other. But my answer, no, it's not the same show without Manny. I think that their two characters' traits and the way they manage to be similar and yet so different is a big part of what makes the show interesting.
Again, a perfect segue right into Manny-isms, I'll call them. Man, talk about a character that has just very important, solid, good, simple, straightforward lines that weave so much more depth than the words themselves. Just very, very brilliantly written character.
The one that really gets me, if anything, it's his burning of the car, which is his ultimate quote in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, epic scene altogether.
That also is my number one Manny-ism. I think you have to bring up his quintessential line at the car burning, though, which is, nothing on this planet is yours. You cannot give me anything because all you have is stolen. You do not belong here. And that was just so poignant in that single moment. And I want to bring up another one in the finale. And I thought this one added so much depth to Manny and showed his dark side a little bit. It's when they're having the conversation under the umbrella. He says, these weirdos are evil. They've stolen everyone's soul. If we can't fix them, they are better off dead.
But he will do everything in his power, I think, to try to fix them. In his mind, he's able to visualize the idea that I'll try everything, but if we can't, in my opinion, they're better off dead. And what is he also saying there? He's saying, if that were me, I would be better off dead. So I think that brings up a lot of things inside of his own thought process and his personal philosophy and how he is approaching this. And you guys did such a great job of alluding to his maybe religious or moral or philosophical reasons for doing what he's doing and in the way that he is doing it. But we've certainly realized in the last couple episodes that he can go dark if he needs to. I think the other main character in this is the hive mind or the joined, or as Josh and I like to call them, the weirdos. Are they a villain, or is this an invitation to something that is the greatest form of happiness we can ever experience?
I think Joe put it very aptly earlier, where if someone is trying to push their agenda on you against your will, then they are a villain. And that's very much what they're doing with Carol and the rest of the survivors to a point, since I know some of the survivors willingly do want to become one of the joined. But I think they are very much in the villain category, even if their goals are admirable, even in their eyes. Does the end justify the means? And in my mind, it doesn't. Taking away the individuality and the creativity of the human race isn't worth whatever this project is that is extraterrestrial in origin.
Let me ask you this. At what point in the series did you go, they're the villain?
That's a tough question. It probably wasn't until the end. I think even when we found out that they were utilizing human bodies as their sustenance, I didn't necessarily mark them as an out-and-out villain. I think it's the realization that Carol came to with the fact that they were going to force themselves upon Carol and the rest of the survivors, that they truly became the villain. I don't know. It's still tough.
I would posit that we still don't know if it's actually an atom bomb or not. Carol can lie, and she can also be colorful in her descriptions. So I would like to think that it could be an atom bomb as far as the joined were concerned. Let's throw in a stupid theory here for a real quick second, since that is part of our show. What if what's in there is actually some sort of a satellite array or something that shoots a beam or shoots a signal into space, or not even space, but the space around Earth or around people or You know, there's such a thing as sonic weapons. What if they were able to utilize that frequency with a sonic gun and point it towards the joint, and they are able to fall down and become individuals again, which is what I would hope to expect. I don't know. I like the idea that it's not an atom bomb, but it's an atom bomb in relation to the joint. Joe, it seems like you firmly land in the court of episode 9 as the big reveal for villainhood. Do you have further thoughts on that, or do you feel strongly about that?
I turn to the great storytellers to try to be surprised with things like that. So for me, the dream is that somehow it turns out that it is a little bit bigger picture than whether they're actually a villain or not. And at this point, I still see the genius of the show leaving me a little bit of an out. I mean, even when we talk about them being cannibals, it is something that the collective, all people, have agreed to do to marshal their resources. And they say, we honor their sacrifice. I believe they're referring to all the people who died during the joining when they say that, who weren't capable of hunting them and died. Right. So,
well, and the people that continue to die too.
Right. So at the end of the day, my perspective is that clearly the show is playing in a form where they are the villain and Carol and Menousos are the heroes.
I love a gray protagonist. Walter White is a perfect example of that. I love ambiguity in a story. As I mentioned before, I'm a suspicious person. So when I see suspicious behavior, I'm going to kind of keep an eye on it. And despite whether anyone on the planet knew that a rat bit a scientist, later on, it is unconsensually passed on. And the philosophy in its heart is corrupt. And that's the part that bothers me the most. I say it all the time. I equate it to some version of a really terrible religion where you absolutely don't have a choice. And we have enough of that. None of these people got the opportunity to make the choice. Every single one of them had it forced on them. So when you have that, and then you just tell everybody through this philosophy and apparently collective thought, which again, I don't think that's what this is, that it's okay to grind up humans and make milk out of them. It's beyond me. Does that mean that as a joint, I have the individual choice to say, no, I would like to not eat other humans, please? No, you just drink the milkshake. So for me, when they snapped out of it in the hospital is when I had my major red flag. And my favorite part of that is when she's getting back into the truck, they all say, hello, Carol, at the same time. And she did what most people don't do, where she would go, how do you know my name, or anything like that. She just jumped in that truck and peeled out backward and got out of there as quickly as she could. There's nothing right about any of this. And Manny points it out in a beautiful way when he's talking to the joint version of his mother. And whether the line is funny or not, and whether we have great relationships with our mothers or not, the point is he knows that the person that's standing in front of him absolutely is not the person they were before, and something is wrong, even if they're a quote-unquote better person now or are behaving better. They're not. And again, as we see Kusamayu's village being dismantled seconds after she turns, it all just becomes more and more layers of wrong, 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 wrong. That's not what human beings do.
That also begs the question of, since it is a biological imperative, do you scold the lion for hunting and eating the gazelle? Or do you scold the gazelle for fighting back and running away from the lion? Is it the fact that they are sentient of their actions that matter? Does that make it any different? Is that evil to follow your biological imperative?
Again, I don't see it as a biological imperative. We talked about what a biological imperative is. It's to procreate so that you can grow your race into perpetuity. It's not to do any of the things that they're doing. It's not biological not to feed yourself. It's not biological to eat other human beings. Those two make my point alone.
The question I have when I'm listening to what you're saying is, are these actions evil and wrong, or are they alien? And are we just looking at an intelligence that operates on a different level, and we're assigning human values to something that is now evolved past them and has a different thought process? My friend John, who you know, mentioned the other day, when we talk about biological imperative, what we have is a virus. And viruses don't stop. Because I said, why is the whole world so worried about 12 people? Why do they care so much about turning Carol? Like, why don't they just leave her alone? And he said, because viruses don't leave you alone. That's their imperative, is to spread. So are we just looking at a viral infection that is not going to stop spreading?
Or that could be, you know, taken care of by a frequency or love or something else like that. Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that level. The way that they're behaving is, yes, it is viral, definitely, and it is as stupid as a virus can be. It's still going to do what it needs to do to continue to grow. Their behavior, though, isn't collectively by choice, in my opinion. I don't believe it's every mind on the planet that is joined, is coming together in an invisible room and having conversations at length and making decisions for the collective. I don't believe that at all. What I do believe is they are programmed, and the RNA is a sequence that gets dropped into their DNA that reprograms them to do what they're doing, which is make the stupidest decisions human beings could possibly make for the quote-unquote betterment of their species. I don't believe they're working toward the betterment of their species. I strongly believe that they are cattle and slaves, and they're going to be programmed to do exactly what their masters want them to do in this particular instance, which we discovered in a recent episode, apparently probably build an array that's as big as Africa so that we can use all of the energy of the planet to shoot a signal across the universe. So I don't think any of this behavior has anything to do with a philosophy or a group of people coming together to make decisions. It is strictly the programming in the RNA, rewriting your DNA to be charming, to be stupid, to make stupid decisions. And if this RNA sequence tells you, don't pick an apple, it's a living thing, you know, release all the animals. They need to have the freedom to roam the world and, you know, rub up against the Mona Lisa. And no, it's so programming.
You're saying it's turning them into ants.
But frankly, worse, because you're taking what an ant never had, all of the things that human beings have ever created over time, and then making them an ant. You know, some of the first written stories and mathematics and history all come from Mesopotamia. And in these writings, they talk about an alien species that came in and made human beings so that they can be slaves to mine Earth for all of its minerals. I think they're kind of using that thought and saying, we're going to take all this energy, put it into this array, and shoot this signal across 600 million light years in another direction so another planet can fall prey to this RNA rewriting sequence. You know what I would like to go over, fellas, is Carol's whiteboard. I think she has this laid out in such a really great way that it gives us an excellent template for us to follow and maybe have a bit of a discussion here. We know in episode 4, Please Carol, she puts her initial entries in there, and I believe number 1 was eager to please. Is it that they're eager to please, or is it that they have an agenda?
I feel like their eagerness to please is a means to the end for their agenda, absolutely. And their eagerness to please is only to convince the rest of their survivors to succumb to the joint.
And she even goes on to say, would give me a bomb, ! Right? Joe, at number 2, she says, can't kill, not a fly. But when the RNA sequence was initiated, and they even said that they had to escalate the initiation of the RNA sequence because the military became aware of them, but they can kill hundreds of millions of people when they turn us. What do you think about maybe that part of their philosophy?
I find that part of the whole thing just a complete mystery. I can understand the idea of not killing each other, but I find it completely opaque as to why they wouldn't eat meat or why they wouldn't pick an apple. That, I guess if anything, at this point feels like a contrivance to me. It doesn't really make sense. Is it a malevolent entity, or is it just a tornado, which is a confluence of events, of forces?
Number three on her whiteboard is, don't play favorites, like all jerks the same. You'd think that she might have remembered this in episode 8 and 9 as she fell for the charm offensive. Josh, what do you think about them playing favorites or not?
This is one of the things that hurt Carol so deeply in episode 9. And that's when Zosia admits to Carol that we love him just as much as we love you. And Carol responds by saying, you can't love him. He's a stranger. You're mine. And she has that possessiveness over Zosia at that point. It's one of the disappointments, I thought, in Carol's character here, because she knew this information already. She knew it, and she's willingly pulling the wool over her eyes. So I do think that they don't play favorites. I do think they love all jerks the same.
On her fourth line, she has, trying to change me, with an exclamation point, and it's underlined. She, again, her own advice she has on the wall says that they have a biological imperative to change her, and she knows it. And even early on in episode 4, she didn't know at this point that she could, quote unquote, and I use big quotes for that, opt out of becoming a part of the join. So she was pretty strong about it early on, and I think she forgot to heed her own advice. Number 5, weirdly honest, question mark, that relates to can't lie. And I think Carol honestly believes they can't lie. Joe, do you think they can be duplicitous or lie by omission?
You can tell on Zosia's face when they don't want to say something. Are you lying if you don't say something, but your face tells me the answer? It's another one of those mysteries, though. How would we really know, you know, at this point?
Let me ask you this. Did you grow up in a world where you could lie by omission and get in trouble for that?
Oh, certainly, yes. Having an emotion and having a hard time saying something that you don't want to say feels human to me. So when they're like, well, we really don't want to tell you this, but yes, we'll bring you an atom bomb. So far, it doesn't seem like they've lied.
I don't know, man. If they're going to play James Bond for you, and then the moment you turn your back, become a robot again, that seems like a lie. Even if we are play acting, but it's so weirdly fake.
Kumba could be kidding himself that they're doing what they want to do and involving him in it, but I don't think us as the viewers for a second believe that it's anything else. And the fact that they don't keep up the ruse that they're obviously putting on for his benefit when he leaves the room doesn't necessarily say anything to be beyond that they want to keep him happy, or at least complacent.
We're putting you in your cage until it's time for you to take your shot. Mm-hmm. One of my least favorite things about the show, and I still struggle with it, her line 6 is, they eat people. Again, if I was on a date and my date wanted to eat people for dinner, apparently it doesn't seem to be a deal breaker for Kumba. It seemed like it was a deal breaker for Carol. She made some very, very good points early on, but eventually it wasn't. So, Joe, is eating people a deal breaker for you? I guess that's my question.
if an alien race landed on the Earth and said, we're going to level everybody up and your lives are all going to be better. And then we found out that when their people die of a natural death, they consume them. Would that be a deal breaker? Because it certainly seems alien to us as humans. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's evil.
I'm literally asking, like, you're on a date and Zosia's looking at you and she goes, by the way, I want to just tell you this before the date goes any further. I eat people.
Are we the last two people on the planet?
What about you, Josh? Once it came down to the HDP, yeah, you know me, are you like, no?
What is that colloquialism for eating humans? I'm trying to remember. It's on the tip of my tongue.
It's like eat the rich or something like that?
No, no. It's long pig. So if my date said they wanted to eat long pig for dinner, I think that would be an
I want a double. I'm on a double order of long pig. And by the way, make it into a eggnog milkshake for me, would you?
For the record, yes, that would be a deal breaker for me on that date.
Well, now she discovers in episode 8, of course, that they have communal sleeping and the cuddle puddle. And is it for energy efficiency? And why are they so steadfast in their energy efficiency? Joe, what was your take when you discovered that this is how the joined go to bed, is that they all pile up into this hockey rink and just sleep on the floor?
Puzzlement. I didn't understand why they wouldn't at least have cots or something. It seems to suggest that, you know, nobody's home in the drones. So I just find that strange. Is individuality gone, or is it in a suspension? It seems to suggest that it's gone to me.
When you also start to think about art or film, or how enamored they are with the possibility of her writing again. And I believe it's true. I think they're starved for something new, because there will not be anything new once everyone is joined on the planet. They'll all just be joined and be sleeping on the floor, apparently. I found it to be really weird. It's also how one would treat their slaves. You're not going to give them the best place to sleep. You can sleep on the floor and you can eat, you know,
I'm curious,
human milkshake.
I'm curious what makes you think that they actually like the story and they're not just saying that to make Carol happy, but why do we believe that they actually love it?
That was the impression I got when Zosia and Carol are sitting on the stair, and Zosia had just read the first chapter and she's giving her take on it. They get extremely nerdy in the best way possible, like two people that are eyeball deep in fantasy novels would. I think that there are probably some Easter eggs in some of the fantasy language that they're dropping, and maybe even some plot points when they're talking about this first chapter. I think it also has a lot to do with the subject matter itself. Having the main character become female now because she has always wanted to, I still strongly believe that Carol's doing that wholly on purpose for the join to get a reaction out of them. She also had absolutely nothing to lose at this point, because once Helen was assimilated, they know everything about Carol and everything about Helen and all the other people that have interacted with Carol throughout her entire life, including her Nana and her cousins. So she had nothing to lose inching the character. But I felt that Zosia's response to it wasn't acting. I felt like it was the joint as a whole delighting in something new. What would be the best drug for the joint? It would be something new. It would be something that they couldn't get anywhere else. Remember Zosia's response when they were standing on the plateau and watching the train deliver the food? She claimed to not know that Carol loved trains, and that Carol thought that a train whistle was the loneliest sound in the world. They didn't know that. And I would posit again that Carol made that up to test them. I think all of that kind of comes into play when we talk about that.
So why would they want to bring her into them if she brings them so much joy being separate from them?
It's that stupid biological imperative / programming.
The virus.
You know, when she has the conversation with Zosia at the table and Zosia is speaking in first person, it did feel like we were getting the unique singular version of Zosia in that moment, and that there is a possibility of that happening in the future. And I think it's going to be the marriage of that and the radio signal with Manny to make this thing happen. I think that when you push a person in that direction hard enough in the joint, that they will want that individuality back, because they will crave something new. And they will know that that's the only way they're going to get it, is by unique experience and not by a joined experience that's been watered down and homogenized.
That is my preferred version. There's also the simpler possibility that they are using their feigned interest to appease Carol, and instead of working on a way to unjoin the weirdos, that she's instead working on the next Waikaro novel.
I think it can be both. I think it could totally be both. I think that they do want to distract her and have her do anything else, but I think that they do also hunger for something unique and new, and they know that they can't get it unless you have unjoined. I didn't know that the cuddle puddle was going to get so intense there, so I'm kind of pleased by that. When we get to number 8, it's communicate via body's electromagnetic field. Joe, what was your response when Zosia explained, I'll say very loosely, how they communicate with each other?
My eyes glazed over a little bit. it felt to me a little bit like space mumbo jumbo. I didn't draw any major conclusions from it personally. I did think back to Josh pointing out how, you know, it's not magic, and Manny listening to the frequencies.
Well, Josh, I know you had some leanings toward the way that they communicate, and what were your thoughts when Zosia was explaining some of the background of how they communicate with each other?
I thought this was a little strange, actually. She specifically mentions the body's electromagnetic field, but when Carol specifically asks if it's similar to radio, she says, no, it's a homeostatic, so it's like breathing. But we do find out that there is actually a radio frequency that they operate on from Minuso's.
Well, and maybe she was doing another one of those instances where she doesn't tell the whole truth. Again, it always makes me question almost anything that they say, really, whether it's the truth or not. What I liked about it, though, is that they were leaning into science being the answer to their communications. Number 9 on her whiteboard list is trains to transport food. As we saw earlier, I just want to note that the train was insanely long, and that the entire series is loaded with large planes, so they're constantly transporting something, and I can't imagine that it's just food. So I think there's much more going on, a la Mr. Robot, than we might suspect, just on the surface here. Number 10, we have individuals feel, everyone knows, and this is supposed to be the phrase that sort of explains the hive mind. Josh, what were your thoughts when you heard individuals feel, everyone knows, and how did you embrace that as an understanding of how the hive mind itself sort of works?
I thought it was a really, really apt way to point how the hive mind are able to perceive everything that's going on constantly. It makes a lot of sense on how they're able to still operate. It still begs a question of what their abilities are at the end of the day.
I took that moment as a little bit of leaning into my theory about the transcendence of joining. If you're able to shut out parts and be here and not there.
Yeah, it reminds me of John Cena explaining when people die of accident or natural causes, that they appreciate their sacrifice and that they appreciate their contribution. It made it sound like, number one, thank you for sacrificing yourself I want to think of ancient culture sacrificing people in that phrase. And the other one was thank you for your contribution, which is essentially like thank you for all the data that you've provided to us from your memories and your connection to the world and your knowledge and apparently your muscle memory too. The thought that crossed my mind was that means that you have some sort of a governor that says you can switch it off or you can tone down how much of it you get so that you don't lose your mind, so that it doesn't become unbearable. Line number 11, she has a signal from Kepler-22b, 640 light years away. That's just a good confirmation for her. And number 12, we have building giant antenna using all the power in the world to send signal to space. And giant antenna is in all caps. This pops when she's asking Zosha, what do you need all of this energy for?
Yeah, I believe this is the conversation that they're having as they're overlooking the long train.
She says, why are you conserving all this energy? And she says, so that we can spread the message. And she says, how? And when she says how is when they do that jump and it's giant antenna on the whiteboard. And then the rest of the phrase saying, using all the power in the world to send a signal to space. Again, that alone, huge red flag here. And again, you would think that that would be another thing that would help defend her against the charm offensive. But apparently it wasn't.
Is our whole planet just a Wi-Fi extender for an alien race?
It's definitely a theory. I like the idea that the signal bounced off of either the water planet that it came from, Kepler-22b, or the people or creatures that inhabit that planet, and it's been broadcast to us, and now it's literally just our job is to just bounce it off to the next portion of the universe. I mean, it's a horrifying thought because it makes you feel extremely small and insignificant that you were only here to bounce this message over to this other planet as we completely destroy your planet and use all of its energy, and we don't care if you literally all die off. So, I mean, pretty bleak. I can't imagine that Vince is heading in that direction there.
Well, doesn't that remind you of right now the debates with what they're using power for AI? Like, we're going to birth this thing that's going to basically run the world, and we're going to use up all the energy to do it.
Again, I don't think that Vince is going to be able to fight how closely this story is related to what's actually happening in the world right now. So, yeah, I would have to agree with you there.
Another thing I would point out, I would go back to the cuddle puddle, where there is a portion on the side that says sex, ? Because we have brought up the question, is the hive mind breeding? But I think this adds into the idea that maybe the whole point is solely just to send the message. Their biological imperative is to continue this message onto the next planet. Up until this episode, we haven't seen anything from the perspective of the hive mind, except for once, and that's in the cold open of episode 2, in which we're introduced to Zosha. So throughout this entire time, we don't know what the hive mind is doing outside of the perspective of our protagonists. There is a larger goal at work here, and it very much does seem like it's pointing them to power down the planet as much as possible so that they can build this antenna, power it enough to send the signal, and it doesn't matter if they die in 10 years as long as they accomplish that goal.
I can subscribe to that. It's like Joe was saying, it's you're an ant now, or you're a worker bee, and then that's it. But doesn't that seem like a tremendous regression for the human species? It also brings it back around to Minuso's comment under the pink umbrella where he says, isn't it evil to treat a man the same you would treat an ant? And maybe that's the point. Good catch. I think we're doing great on her whiteboard. I also want to mention that they have published one chapter from her upcoming novel. If you want to go to Apple Books and pick up a copy of that chapter, you can actually read a Carol Sturka chapter. This brings us to Josh's favorite segment, which is superlatives. I would like to ask Josh, what was your favorite scene in season one?
I think it's pretty hard to beat the burning of Manusso's car. I think that is pretty far and away my favorite scene. I'm going to go all the way back to episode one, and that is the initial joining when we see Helen begin her turning, and we see Helen fall on the back of her head in a very sickening way, and we have our first interaction with the hive mind. Well, I think that was so immaculately shot, and it just really set up the intriguing nature of the show as a whole.
Yeah, that was a good sequence altogether. Joe, what is your worst scene from season one?
Ooh, I guess if I have to pick one, I'm just going to go with the reveal of the Soylent Green. And it was just a disappointment to me just because I really wanted to be surprised, and I felt very not surprised.
I'm going to say the most underrated scene is when she's sitting in the bottom of the recycle container and she says, "These motherfuckers sure do love their milk." I lost it when she popped that line. I had to pause it and laugh because it was so funny. Josh, what was your biggest surprise this season? Where did they catch you off guard and you were jumping out of your seat?
That's a tough one for me. I think the biggest surprise for me was fairly early on, and it was the sort of jovial, agreeing nature of the hive mind. I was so used to hive minds or hordes or antagonists that are evil in nature, and having an antagonist seemingly so agreeable really caught me off guard, and I thought was so unique.
Joe, do you have something from this first season that you just can't stop thinking about? You just keep revisiting it.
It is that we just don't know what it's like to be one of the joined. That is what I keep coming back to, and it is what keeps me thinking. That is the ultimate question I have at this point is, what is it? What is it like in there?
Where's the beef, one might say. I think that the HDP thing is the dumbest plot point in the whole series. I just find it just atrociously idiotic, and that's my hot take, unpopular opinion, and doesn't work other than to illustrate that the hive mind are emphatically stupid. All right, I'm trying to be mean. It's not working. I think those are some pretty solid superlatives that we can throw at the series. This segment we're going to hop into here real quick is going to be about the prime number theory, but I'm going to simplify this as much as possible to allow everybody to try to wrap their head around it. Every timestamp in the show uses days, hours, minutes, and seconds. I tracked all of them. The pattern, the scenes with hope, resistance, or individual triumph use prime numbers. Scenes with despair, surrender, or the hive mind dominance use composite numbers. Prime numbers cannot be divided, so they stand alone. They are indivisible. And prime numbers are attributed to our heroes. Composite numbers are made of parts. They are divisible. When we began, we had 13 immune. 13 is a prime number. I like the idea that we have a bookend theory, that we started 439 days before the joining, and that this thing would wrap up at the 439th day after the joining. I think that would be really cool, and it would kind of fit with Vince's theme with his other stories that he's told. I have another simple version of the number theory, and that is literally that he just is putting up timestamps and they don't mean anything at all, which would be frankly funnier, and I would be more than happy with
chaos that. Theory.
But that is, yeah, no kidding. Please, I love it. I will say something though. In the last episode, we saw where Kusumayo was turned at day 71, and then we bounced back to the 60s when Carol and Manusos met. I need to know what happens between those days up to that point and how relevant that is to Carol and to Manusos. and if they have any play in any of that at all. I'm very, very curious, especially with the way that Kusamaya was behaving before she turned. To me, it seemed like she was very reticent to do it, and she didn't really want to do it, but they had their own charm initiative on her, and it obviously worked. So, I'm very, very curious. That leads us to this portion, which we will call Season 2 Predictions, and I would love to pick your brains and find out if either of you have any really solid predictions for what could happen in Season 2. Joe, you want to take the reins?
I don't have a lot of predictions, to be honest with you. I had a lingering thought that I'm wondering is going to be a thread in it, which is this notion we're going to learn that there's an aspect to Carol and Helen's relationship that was not golden.
When it comes to Helen and Carol's relationship, why hadn't they fertilized those eggs? They seem to lead a charmed life. She's a successful author. Helen is successful in managing her. People are looking forward to her next works. They're begging her not to kill characters off. It seems like a prime time to have a child. But as we learn, she obviously has issues with drinking, and that has colored her life. And I think you're right. I think there is some underlying not so good stuff with their relationship. Josh, do you have predictions for Season 2?
Yeah, I think this season in particular was so much about bringing together Carol and Manousos. And I think we're going to expand our protagonist pool out a little bit. And I think Lakshmi is going to play a much larger role in Season 2. And I could very much see her coming to the realization that her son is not who she believes he is anymore. I, for one, am a big Lakshmi fan, so I'm hoping to get a little bit more of her next season.
I do like the idea that Carol and her influence and Manousos and his smarts with the radio signal are key to potentially turning people that are joined back into their individual selves. I can see that there is a possibility of losing joined people. I think it could break a joined if they didn't have themselves individually to latch onto on the inside, and then maybe they'll be thankful and maybe they won't. What if we brought Kusamayu back and she got really mad at us for turning her back and she was absolutely happy? Would it be like coming off of a very powerful drug, relinquishing yourself from the connection to the joined? Would you Jones for it, so to speak? If you guys were to give the first season a final grade, Joe, what would your final grade of Season 1 be?
Mine would be B plus or A minus. I don't have a lot of quibbles with the show. I basically enjoyed the entire experience. I find a hard time picking out scenes that I don't like or aspects of it that I don't like. It feels so much like all of the elements of it are bricks in a wall. And it all seems to lock together so well. There's such good performances. It surprises me a lot. And that's one of the things I most ask for. And better than all that, it's got me thinking a lot. And which participating in this podcast with you guys has really given me the opportunity to dig in more than I even did before. And, you know, there's nothing like a show where when you dig into it, there keeps being more layers.
That's what happens when you do the deep dive into the hive mind. Josh, what is your final grade on Season 1?
I would give it a very solid B, maybe even the B plus. It was specifically the final episode that brought it down to that grade for me. I'm still a stickler for that ending, the lack thereof for this season. It's in my top five of television shows for this year, certainly, but I'm still a little bit disappointed from it, quite honestly.
Well, if you were my professor and you told me that you were going to give me an A, but that you were a little bit disappointed, I think I'll take the A and not ask any questions further. I'm right there with you. It was in my top five for television this year as well. I'm going to say it's not quite a solid A. I might give it an A- just for a handful of things, and some of it might be a little bit of pacing. But I'll say this, when we started E Pluribus Unum, we talked about how Vince Gilligan was trying to prove that he's not a one-trick pony. And I think he succeeded. What is the entire season about? How could you sum it up in one sentence? And if I ask myself that question, I'll say that season one asks whether connection requires the death of the individual, and they don't answer that question. They refuse to give us that answer, and I kind of like that. And that's the part that intrigues me and makes me want to go further with it. It's not just the mechanics of how things work. It is, does this one thing affect the other in such a detrimental way that we lose creativity or art or individuality? Or is it really this lovely thing that Zosia claims that it is? And I'm super glad that they didn't even come close to answering that. It's too early to compare season one against anything else that he's done. But if season two delivers, it does have the potential to be maybe his most ambitious work, depending on where he goes with it. It's definitely his most philosophical, interestingly. I will say this, and Josh may be dismayed, but it does beat Lone Gunman, but just barely. Well, that wraps up our E Pluribus Unum episode 10, the overview of Pluribus season one. Once again, I want to thank Joe for joining us. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in here and do a deep dive in the hive mind.
Thanks for inviting me to join with you. It was communal.
Josh, how are you feeling about E Pluribus Unum episode 10? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, I've got a lot of feelings. You know, it's been such a journey over the last couple months that we've done this show, and getting up to 3,000 listeners out there all across the globe. So many different countries that I would never have guessed would sit down and listen to us jabber on about some TV show. So I'm incredibly thankful for that. I'm incredibly thankful to have this time with you guys and talk some science fiction. It's one of my great passions in life. And Carol, our feelings for you haven't changed, and we don't need our space over here. So I would still love for everyone to join us on Discord and talk some theories on season two. And it has been such a blast, and it's been such a great way to end my personal 2025.
I have to jump on board with all of the thank yous for everyone as well. It's been a marvelous ride. It's gone so quickly over the last couple of months. We've met some really great people, had some really phenomenal conversations. We just want to keep that stuff going. We're having such a blast. We will be continuing episodes over at Dad, You're Wrong, where a Gen X dad and millennial son talk film, philosophy, and everything in between. But in the meantime, Carol, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the show. You know that we created it specifically for you because Pluribus is your favorite show and E Pluribus Unum is your favorite podcast. Thank you, everybody.